Welcome to Friday, the 23rd of June. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, when we take a breath and consider what happened this week and why it matters. We're on Twitter at KUOW. My name is Bill Radke. My panel this hour, Erica C. Barnett, covering politics at thecisforcrank.com. Ron Sims, former King County Councilman, County Executive, Deputy Secretary at Housing and Urban Development. And Kirby Wilbur, former chair of the Washington State Republican Party. Now he's back on your radio hosting mornings on KVI. Hi there.
Bill, how are you?
Good to see all of you. Thanks for coming.
You bet. Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
Well, no question, the most jarring event this week was the killing of Charlena Lyles, a Seattle woman who called police to report a burglary. The two cops who showed up say she pulled two knives on them. We don't have video. We have some audio of the encounter. Then both officers fired their guns, and those bullets killed Charlena Lyles, and there have been protests all week. This is Charlena Lyles' sister, Monica Williams.
My nephew had to step over his mother's body to get out of the house. What 11-year-old boy deserves to go through that?
So now Seattle and the national media, too, are asking questions like, how scared should those cops have been? Why didn't they de-escalate the situation or run away? And was race a factor? As I said, Ron Sims, we don't have the video because Seattle police don't wear body cameras. Do you think we'll ever have the answers to these questions?
I think we're going to have the answers to the questions. There's a lot of forensic work you can do. I'm actually a body camera fan. I think that was important. I think we're reminded again that you need to have body cameras. But there's a lot more to this. It's really interesting. When I was on the committee along with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal when we were looking for a new chief, and we ended up with the two top candidates being those that best handled a shooting incident in their areas and had a substantial amount of support from people of color. I think what we're beginning to, this is going to be a really good test as to whether or not what we put in place will work, which is you're going to have the officers, you're going to have forensics. But the other side of this that just never gets discussed is that the mental health system broke down. And you can't excuse that. I'm sorry, you just can't. So you had everything that was going to be important in her life not working at all. Right. So this is not just police. That mental health system really needs to be examined as well.
Well, hadn't she been referred to a mental health court of some kind and they released her?
She was under counseling from what I understand. And DSHS says, or CPS says, they can't release what they talked about due to privacy, and I understand that. But I think Ron's absolutely right. This incident happened before the actual shooting. It happened weeks and months ago when the mental health system seemed to fail this woman of four children, pregnant with a fifth, if I understand right. She was in counseling. There had been a police call 2 weeks before where police had responded to a call, and she was sitting on a couch with a pair of scissors with her son, one of her children, in her lap, would not release the scissors. Police had to have a standoff with her, and she eventually let the scissors go. They took her down, and she was arrested, but I think she was given counseling. I don't know if she was in jail. I'd be interested in knowing what they found 2 weeks ago, why they let her go if she was having these problems. But I agree with Ron. This is an entire issue of the mental health system. It's hard for me to believe, and I know there are incidents of wrongful shootings, but it's hard for me to believe those two white officers walked in her apartment that Sunday morning and said, well, we haven't killed someone yet today, or she's black, let's shoot her. If you listen to the tape, there's that sudden turn where they're being very civil, very conversational, and there's a sudden turn, a 180 turn, where she apparently turns to them with knives, and I don't know that we'll know what happened, but I think we need to look at mental health services, how to help these people when they need it, and where we failed in the steps in responding to helping this woman, because she needed help.
Erica?
Well, I don't think that anybody goes into a situation, any officer goes into a situation and says, we haven't killed anybody black yet this month, and so let's do it. I think that that's the reason that the training is about implicit bias. It's not about, you know, explicit racism. It's, you know, this assumption that people who are black have an implicit criminality. I find it hard to imagine the corresponding scenario where the woman was white and had four white kids, including an 11-year-old white boy. And the officer's coming in and shooting her.
You really believe
tiny
that white woman was coming toward them with two knives? It wouldn't stop. They wouldn't shoot her.
I don't think. No, I don't. But I also don't think, as you said, that we know exactly what happened. As far as the mental health system is concerned, I mean, I agree that it definitely failed her. The mental health counseling that she received, as I understand it, took place in jail, and she was jailed for 10 days and then released without additional help. And so the police, knowing that and having that information in their file that she, you know, she had a mental health warning, she had, you know, a prior incident warning, and they went in, you know, just sort of casually talking and not mentioning that, not talking about that with each other, taking no precautions. And so there are a lot of systems that failed here, but I do think the first system that failed was our policing system, which still, you know, I mean, the city is still under a DOJ consent decree that says that they have an appearance of biased policing. And I think this is another example.
They may have talked about it. They may not have talked about it in the room, but if you listen to the entire tape, the one officer says, "I know this woman. There is a note apparently in her file that she does have mental health issues." They refer to that in the earlier part of the tape. So the one officer is very aware there's an issue, and he doesn't bring it up again and suggest that we have to deal with it a certain way. But one of the two officers knew there was an issue here when they went in that room.
I'm not going to let anybody off the hook. System failed her. I mean, I'm not going to point a finger at who was at fault. You had an accumulative failure of all the things that she needed to protect herself and her kids.
I agree.
And it failed all her one time when it cost her life. And, you know, to me, it's not, I don't want a police fix independent of the mental health fix. I don't want a mental health fix independent of the police fix.
Yep.
Because that happens all over the country. We always want somebody to blame, but we will not blame all the other factors that influenced a poor outcome. And I want it all fixed.
This week, yeah, I talked with someone who is a Seattle police officer and a Republican state legislator from Enumclaw, Morgan Irwin. he agreed that the social service system failed Charlena Lyles and said he is I asked, so does that mean you're proposing more money for it? And he said that he has called for that. On the subject of police, the head of the Seattle Police Union told Cairo that the officers did the right thing. In fact, because there's been a question about what about a taser, which they didn't have with them? What about a baton or pepper spray? And the Kevin Stuckey, who's African-American, head of the police guild, said that police are trained to meet lethal force with lethal force, and they followed policy.
I think that for police not to have discretion and to have that as an excuse, we just followed policy, is, if that is the case, is a real oversight in our police in our policing. Because if cops can't go in and tell the difference between, you know, a large man charging at them with a gun and a 100-pound woman, you know, holding a kitchen knife.
And she may have been charging at them. That's one of the things we don't know, right?
She may have been. But my point is that police, you know, sort of fall back on, well, this is our policy. It reminds me of, we were just following orders. You know, we didn't have any choice but to kill this woman. There needs to be discretion. And I think that a reasonable person would use discretion in a situation like that. And so I don't buy the explanation that this was just what they were required to do, kill this woman.
When they train the police, they teach a rule of 21, called 21 feet. If an individual with a knife is within 21 feet of you, they can get to you and stab you before you can draw your gun from the holster, if your gun's in the holster. It's a standard policy in police departments across the country. Knives are more dangerous than people think. Now, we don't know yet. My understanding is, we haven't verified, that she had a knife in each hand approaching the officers. If you listen to the tape, she's told 9 times, "Get back or drop it. Get back or drop it." We don't know what was behind the officers. We don't know if the door was behind them. They're up against a wall. There's a lot we have to know before we can make, I think, the proper judgment. But the police department is taught to teach to respond to lethal force or lethal force. A non-respondent person, non-cooperative person, a drunk, someone on drugs who's told to get in the car and doesn't. Tasers are designed for that. Tasers are not necessarily designed to take down an armed suspect approaching you with possible lethal force. And we have to verify if that was true, if she was approaching them, if she refused to drop the weapons, if she's close to them with a knife, that knife can kill as well as a gun. And the policy may be wrong, but that's how police are trained. And I think Ron's right. Nobody should be let off the hook in this. This whole thing has to be looked at, because you could blame the police, say it's another shooting, but that doesn't deal with the next Miss Lyles, who is not treated right in the mental health system when this happens again and again and again. We got to go to the very root and find out what's going on.
There was a King County police officer who was killed on a discretionary decision. The person was close. The person was dangerous.
Wasn't that out in Newcastle?
That is correct.
That's right.
And so when you, and I had security for 13 years, and so you hear the officers talking about, how do you make that judgment? I mean, it's easy to be, you know, on the bench looking, but when an officer is trained to look at not only whether the person has a weapon, are they following instructions? Are my instructions clear and coherent? Is the person responding to a clear and coherent instruction? Because you can have a person actually of any size, as long as they have a weapon, bring great harm. And we lost a sheriff's officer who you look at and you say, he did everything right that I would want, and he lost his life over it. So I'm not going to fault anybody now. That's why you have investigations. That's why you look and see whether there are protocols. That's why there's a whole series of things. But I will say, and I am unequivocal on this, the system failed her badly.
So then let's end on a solution. Given everybody has a different take, based on what you bring to this, what do you think is one thing that ought to change that we could do differently?
I think we need more intensive training on implicit bias and on racial bias among officers. I think that is once. And we need better training of all police officers in non-lethal responses to situations like this.
Focusing on the police and their training would not have prevented this woman from having an issue in an episode. We need to go back. How do we treat mental patients? How do we treat people with mental issues? Are we treating them properly? How do we do this? This poor woman had four children living on her. She was deathly afraid CPS would take her children, from what we understand. Why was she in the state she was in? Why would she put herself in a position to hazard her life? The police, I would agree that maybe we should look at that, but that's not the number one thing. Number one thing is to go back to the system. We don't need more women with mental issues being shot by police because they put themselves in the situation. Where did we fail her?
So, Ron, when we blame the system, what's one solution?
Well, I think the mental health system needs to be, one, we got to fund it.
It's a matter of money.
It's a matter of money. It's a matter of making it a priority. Secondly, I want to go to the implicit bias. I'm not going to let anybody off on that one. I've been stopped eight times. Just stopped eight times because I was a black male driving a car. So that implicit bias is there. The real issue is, how do you train that away from people in terms of their response? So I believe more training is important of officers on the issue of implicit bias. I think it's really important to have the mental health system understand, don't just release a person. In the case that she was in jail for, there should have been a fairly robust network of mental health providers and engagement on her, because you understood the complexity of her issues, where she was living, the number of kids she had, her physical condition. So, like I said, this is, to me, I'd like for once in this city to see the whole of a problem that affected a person's life dealt with. When we had a person who was mentally ill who shot a fire chief, the whole system was put on in place, and that resulted in us having 24-hour care at Harborview Hospital, release terms, a whole series of things. The mental health system being able to put people who are critical in the hospital and to control them, that's what we need right now. We need a big fix, but I'm not going to hold any part of it responsible when I think it's pox on all of them.
Okay, speaking of mental health, we're going to catch up on what's going on with health care insurance in this country. Also, Seattle's mayor calls for more rules on landlords, and who's going to be the next mayor, and more coming up on The Week in Review with Ron Sims, Erica C. Barnett, and Kirby Wilbur. Stay tuned. Kirby Wilbur used to be the chair of the Washington State Republican Party. He's on radio mornings now on KVI. He loves his country and is unapologetically American.
There you go.
Ron Sims, former King County councilman, county executive, worked for President Obama at HUD, a deputy secretary there. Erica C. Barnett covers politics for you at thecisforcrank.com. And we're covering the week in review now. And this week, Senate Republicans unveiled their plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Like the House bill, the Senate bill would roll back President Obama's expansion of Medicaid. Former state Republican Chair Kirby Wilbur, pretend that you are Republican Congressman Dave Reichert of Auburn. Mm-hmm. And the Congressional Budget Office has just predicted that both the House and Senate plan would leave tens of millions of people without health insurance. Congressman Reichert, what do you tell your constituents? Why is this a great bill?
Well, what I would tell them is I'd work to fix that bill to make sure that doesn't happen. And because I don't think the bill should throw people off. The expansion of Medicaid that took these people in, it's important to provide this insurance for people. I'm not so sure that when the CBO comes out of that score, that would be true. But I would not do that. Because
well, it was, 23 million with a House bill, and you think it's going to be radically different?
Well, CBO isn't always right. Mm-hmm. CBO made some projections on Obamacare. It didn't turn out quite right either. So I'd want to look at the CBO report and see how they come up with that conclusion, because they're not always right. I know it's the Bible, but it's not always right. I think Obamacare can be repealed and replaced in such a way that the people who got insurance are provided with the insurance. And in fact, if we want to achieve that, most of the people who got insurance under Obamacare got it by going to Medicaid, by expansion of Medicaid. They didn't do it through the exchanges. In fact, almost as many people got thrown off their private insurance because of Obamacare than added it through the exchanges. So we could have achieved much of what Obamacare achieved without fundamentally altering the private insurance market and by simply expanding Medicaid. We could have done that.
But this bill would roll back that Medicaid expansion.
I understand that. What I haven't read all the details, though, Bill, I don't believe, no matter what anybody says, Republicans are going to kick grandma off of health insurance. All right, we went through that in the 90s with Newt Gingrich, with the little old lady being pushed off the cliff in the wheelchair. There is no way Republicans saying, well, how can we really penalize poor people? Oh, yeah, let's kick them off the insurance.
But now, that's exactly what they're doing.
But they're not going to kick Erica. They're not going to do that. You know that. They're talking about doing this in stages. And Ryan's had a three-stage plan, which didn't come together with the Republicans. But come on. The Republicans aren't going to kick 24 million people and say, you don't have a health insurance, say, Erica, sorry, you're on your own. They're not going to do that. This bill doesn't do that.
You know, actually, I'm on the exchange, and they are going to say that. And, I mean, I am, you know.
You're on the exchange or on Medicaid? There's a difference here.
I understand.
Okay.
But the Medicaid, I mean, this bill rolls back Medicaid. You can't say we're going to create a massive tax cut that is primarily on the backs of Medicaid recipients through cuts to the Medicaid program and also say it is impossible that people are going to get kicked off. That's exactly what's going to happen. The eligibility requirement is going to is going down so that fewer people will be covered. The state subsidies are being reduced. They might be a block grant. People are going to lose their insurance.
But the idea
people
being
are going to lose insurance
grants,
primarily through Medicaid.
The idea being block grants is to give the states more flexibility to deal with the issues they have, because what you get under Obamacare and under Medicaid is one standard for the entire country. But as you know, communities are different, health problems are different, and I think we can trust the states. You may not trust the states. I do.
I don't
to deal with the state
states.
Issues.
So in Washington State, are you saying, because Congressman Reichert and Republican Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler mm-hmm. were no votes against the House health care bill, you think it's going to change so much that they're yes votes?
No. I'd like to say I have not read the bill in great detail, but there is no way they're going to simply tell 24 million people who don't have health insurance.
When Donald Trump was a candidate, he said he was the only Republican candidate promising not to cut Medicaid, and he told CBS's Scott Pelley there will be universal coverage.
Everybody's got to be covered. This is an un-Republican thing for me to say, because a lot of times they say, no, the lower 25%, they can't afford private. But
universal health care.
I am going to take care of everybody. I don't care if it costs me votes or not. Everybody's going to be taken care of, much better than they're taken care of now.
Who pays for it?
The government's going to pay for it, but we're going to save so much money on the other side. But for the most part, it's going to be a private plan, and people are going to be able to go out and negotiate great plans with lots of different competition, with lots of competitors, with great companies, and they can have their doctors, they can have their plans, they can have everything.
So this week I played that tape for the current Washington Republican chair, Susan Hutchison, your successor, and I said, you know, so Trump is not going to fulfill those promises, is he? And Susan said, look, first of all, Donald Trump is a New Yorker.
One of the things that people don't understand about a New Yorker, now my mom's a New Yorker, so she was born in Brooklyn and raised in New York. And so I know the style.
And she said Trump's style in the campaign was not actually to promise what would happen. He was just giving a starting point for negotiation.
When you are negotiating, you cannot start where you want to end up. It's the art of the deal. And I recommend anybody read that book who hasn't read it yet. I think you'll get a lot of insights into Donald Trump. He is not your standard politician in any way, shape, or form.
So, Ron Sims, you were a politician. You ran for governor. You held other offices. When you told reporters about your platform, your policy positions, were you just starting negotiations? Is that an okay, is that a fair standard?
No, I was just sitting here saying, God, it would be great to have Kirby back as chair of the Republican Party.
Thank you, Ron.
We'll get Kirby's comment in a moment.
The answer is no. That's not how you do business. You only have your personal integrity, and the minute you retreat from it or alter it very significantly, it means you have given that up, and nobody has a reason to believe you anymore on anything. And so I can't. My parents are from New York, so for her to say that's how New Yorkers are, I want to say, excuse me.
But the people are tired of gridlock, and they wanted somebody to get something done in a new way, right?
No, they want to drain the swamp, I think. I don't think they were really all that concerned about gridlock. They want to drain the swamp, which you can never drain because the swamp comes with government. Now, I think what Susan was saying, I think, has some truth to it in that Trump made a success as a dealmaker. Trump didn't invent the personal computer. He didn't find a new way to finance real estate. He was a dealmaker, and he made his wealth by making deals. And I think he looked at government and said, we're going to make deals here. That's how we're going to get things done. And so half of what Susan said, I think, may be true, that Trump was not committed to a set of principles. He was committed to a sense of operating principles, not political principles. And I made deals, and so I'm going to make deals in government. I can convince people of this. He always got his deals signed, ready, delivered, and I think he has that approach.
But when Democrats run against Maria Cantwell, run for governor, run for the state legislature, are you going to? Would you, if you were Republican chair, are you saying
no?
Yeah, I'm not holding candidates to their promises.
No, I have a set of principles, Bill, and I'm not a deal maker. I'm very bad at making deals. I have a set of principles that I would present to people and say, this is what I believe in. And if you look back at the 2016 campaign, there weren't a lot of principles. There was a lot of, we're going to make deals and get this done. So I'll just leave it at that before I get in more trouble.
I feel like we're using the term deal maker to mean craven liar. And so
that's not what I meant.
So, Erica. I mean, I could substitute that in everything you've said, though. I mean, I feel like, you know, Donald Trump gets up there and says nobody believed him at the time, I think, who had, you know, any sort of sense of credulity. But I mean, but he was obviously lying because his health care plan, you know, is.
But is he lying or is he wrong? Because remember, he told the House, good job on this. And then after the House passed that bill by one vote, he said, what a mess!
Well, I'm not...
One day he says it's a great deal. One day he says it's a mess. I'm suggesting that Donald Trump is looking at getting something done. He could be wrong. He could be lying.
Well, if he's wrong, I would say then you're arguing that he's woefully underinformed, which I think you could also make a case for that.
The budget he submitted to Congress cut Medicaid. I mean, so, you know, once you do that, he is signaled already. To anybody working on the changes to the Affordable Care Act, that Medicaid is not important to him. But that is important to many of us because that is, no one in this country should go without health insurance and health care. He's already made a decision that's okay. The Senate bill says that's okay. The House bill said that okay. So pox on them, really, because I grew up at a time when I was a kid where we couldn't get health insurance, and there are significant consequences to not being able to do that. To see that come back as a matter of policy is absolutely appalling. We're in the 21st century. We need to commit that everybody, no matter who they are, will have health insurance and access to health care.
Well, then how about this? Let me propose. So then the stuff you're saying that Americans want people to be covered. What if this, because this is the way the Senate bill is structured, the stuff people like, that happens now. The Medicaid reductions come later. So
after
what,
the election.
After the election. So if you're right, and years from now, voters revolt and those cost savings will never actually happen. But on the, from your point of view, positive side, maybe when the Congress flips back and forth, presidency flips back and forth, Democrats control government eventually, and then maybe by that time, if the American voter is as angry as you predict, then they vote for universal health care, single payer.
Which is the goal, I think, ultimately, single payer, Bill. That's the goal.
But this is that's a really disturbing way to think of it, because you're talking about people's lives. You're talking about
in the meantime,
who are going to die from this in the meantime because they don't have health care coverage. Because, you know, because, I mean, people like me, you know, I'm not on Medicaid. You're right, Kirby. But people on the exchanges are going to lose good coverage because there's a built-in death spiral.
Bad coverage, Erica, though. I mean,
I have great coverage.
You may have great
coverage,
but you're going to suggest you couldn't get that coverage without about the exchange.
I am going to because I
millions
think
lost
it sets
their
up
coverage.
A death spiral.
Millions lost their coverage. They saw the deductibles go way up and copays go way up because they were forced to pay for insurance they didn't need. Why should I be forced to pay for neonatal care on a Kirby Wilbur insurance policy?
Because women are part of our healthcare system. Because you probably have
me.
Children. Yes,
I
it
did.
Is.
One
and you probably have
right,
female employees. You probably have had women who you love in
I
your life.
So
just
let
because
them choose that.
Just because women happen to be the people who get pregnant doesn't mean that they should pay more for health insurance coverage. I mean, that is the whole point of insurance is to pay for things that may not happen to you. So
actually, no, that's not the purpose.
Well, it actually, I mean, it maybe from a personal perspective, it's, you know, so you can go to the doctor and get your cancer covered. But if we say we're not going to cover certain conditions, leave aside pregnancy. If we say we're not going to cover, you know, certain catastrophic conditions under your health care coverage, so you can buy a special plan that says I'm never going to get cancer. And then if you get cancer, you can buy a special new plan. That's the death spiral that I'm talking about. So if you set up a situation where people don't have to pay for coverage that they may not use, that's not insurance.
What
and that
about,
is that is just that is just pay as you go healthcare.
What about catastrophic coverage? Or let's even talk about let's even take insurance out of it for a moment, okay? I had minor surgery in February. Minor stuff. I was in at 7:30, out at noon. $26,000 what the hospital charged me. There was for 5 hours. Recovery, prep, surgery, the whole thing. There's a surgery center in Oklahoma City where the doctors operate without insurance companies. You got to pay cash or you got to pay credit. That same surgery in Oklahoma City would cost me $3,200. Same surgery.
So
same
nobody's preventing
doctor.
You from going there.
Exactly. But the point is there's something wrong with the system beyond the cost of insurance when it costs someone $26,000 to get a surgery here.
Oh, sure.
But
I could have totally
gone for $3,200.
Okay, more to say. Ron gets the last word. Okay.
I had two brothers who died of cancer. Built in every insurance policy is money for what you meet, what you don't want to get, but it's risk factor. I don't mind paying for my risk or the risk of other people. Two of my brothers never thought they would die of cancer. They never thought it. Yet built into both their plans was the money to pay for that. And in my plan, health insurance isn't supposed to be uniquely what Ron Sims thinks his health conditions is going to be. We've always thought on insurance policies, whether they're cars or homes or whatever, that we can defray the higher cost per person or per individual by looking at the the risk within a group. So you take my age group and you say within Ron Sims's age group, and he's old, this is what's likely to happen. I may not ever get those illnesses. But somebody will. But if I do get them, somebody else has helped. That's really what's wonderful about the health insurance plans that we have today. We talked about universal health care before. That's what universal health care is. Now, if as Kirby is correct, we are laying the early stages to universal health care. My God, why don't we just do it right now? Because it would be we would have a lot fewer problems and we'd probably have more cost control.
We could have a whole show on that.
Yes, that's right. But actually, this is the Week in Review where we cover a range of topics that happened this week. Right. Thank you for this discussion. And coming up, we're going to talk about what landlords can and can't do again and who might be the mayor of Seattle again or maybe even the same mayor we have now. And what to call this Subaru driver in Kent? Vigilante? Angel? Vigilante angel?
Crazy.
you could whisper that. It's all coming up on The Week in Review. With Erica C. Barnett and Ron Sims and Kirby Wilbur, I'm Bill Radke. It's The Week in Review on Twitter, at KUOW. Who will lead the city of Seattle? The mayor primary is about 5 weeks away. KUOW and King polled Seattle voters, and it's close in that poll. Former Mayor Mike McGinn leads the way with 19% of likely voters. Former federal prosecutor Jenny Durkin, number two with 14%. A third of likely voters said Mayor Ed Murray should have run for re-election. You can read the whole thing at our website, KUOW.org. We'll tweet a link to it now, at KUOW. Erica C. Barnett, it's just one poll. There's a margin of error. What do you take away?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be the one who criticizes this poll, but
go ahead.
But I'm gonna. So this, along with the Washington State Wire poll, both were robo polls. So those are polls where essentially, you know, you get a call and there's a recorded person on the other end and you answer the questions. Those tend to be less reliable than live polls. So why
is that?
That would be a good question to ask a pollster.
Okay.
I think probably because you can ask follow-ups and you can have a conversation with the person, so it's not just reading a list of 21 names, because that's a pretty overwhelming poll to take.
Mm-hmm.
I
have trouble following menu descriptions before I order my dinner, so I can imagine.
Yeah, so the other issue is that when you're asking, would you vote for Ed Murray if he was on the ballot, that's not what anybody is going to be faced with in August. What people are going to be faced with is, will I look at these 21 names and then look past all of them and write in Ed Murray at the bottom? Write-in campaigns are notoriously difficult. Mm-hmm. You have to get people to write in the name, write it in correctly. And it's never happened in the city of Seattle that somebody has been elected on a write-in campaign.
Although Ed Murray would be an unusual case for a write-in campaign.
I mean, everything about this election is unusual.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I think Jenny Durkin, who is kind of the consensus front runner right now, has his consultant.
Not in this poll.
Sure, and that's another issue with the poll. But anyway, Jenny Durkin has a lot of the same supporters. You know, money from Ed Murray is going over to her. She's getting all the endorsements. Ed Murray's going to have to win this without labor unless people start switching endorsements if he runs. And I also think that a poll like this is a poll on name recognition. You haven't started seeing ads on TV yet. I talked to Jessen Farrell this morning. She said she's about to put a big ad out in the field. She's one of the people that came in kind of on the bottom.
Former state legislator.
Right, who resigned to run for mayor. So I think polling on name recognition, Mike McGinn's always going to do well. Now, 30%, 33% would be great if Ed Murray was on the ballot. I mean, that would almost make him a shoe-in in a 21-way race. But he's got polling out in the field. He said at a press conference next week he's going to decide. So we'll see then. But I think it's a really, really challenging battle for him to fight at this point.
I want to ask Kirby something, but this is, sure. Since you brought it up, this is the sound of Murray being asked by reporters, are you considering running as a write-in candidate?
Well, whenever you consider running for office, you have to take into a lot of factors, and certainly have to have a talk with my husband, and we're still feeling wounded from how the allegations were handled, and I just need to spend some time.
Feeling wounded, and he's not finished doing his polling of likely voters either. Kirby Wilbur, yeah. State Republican, former state party chair. It doesn't look good for Republicans in this race.
What Republicans?
I got to tell you.
But they're voting for Mike McGinn.
Here's the question.
I'm starting to wonder.
Here's the question, Bill.
Seriously, if there's even going to be...
Donald Trump won the city sale, or Hillary Clinton. Trump lost it 92-8. Okay. Now, I assume half the Republicans in town didn't vote for Donald Trump. So now it's 16% of the vote are Republicans. This is an interesting question, because in Seattle, typically you have left, moderate left, far left, off the planet left when it comes to candidates running for citywide office. Which of these candidates could move a little bit to the center or offer one policy that might entice half that 8% or half that 16% to say, maybe I'll vote for him or her?
What policy could that be?
I have no idea. I live in the burbs. I grew up here, but I moved out of the city a while back. I have no idea, but it's interesting. What could it be?
Well, I'm waving my hand frantically over here because Survey USA
The chair recognizes
poll,
Erica C. Yeah. Barnett.
The Survey USA poll did sort of answer this question when it found that Republicans, self-identified Republicans, were most likely to go for McGinn. Which is interesting because he was considered, sort of, I don't know, between off the planet and super liberal, but what's
kind of in between?
He's sort of going for a kind of old Seattle. Let's preserve Seattle the way it was. Let's slow down the processes, and maybe that's why he's appealing. It was an interesting little snippet that jumped out at me from those results.
I think if you get the party organizations to get behind someone, you would see some shift in that Republican vote. I know a lot of Republicans in the city. There are some wacky ones. A lot of Ron Paul supporters in the city. I don't know that that was necessarily true in real life. And again, we're talking about a very small, minute part of the population. But if the city the county organization, the city organization, were to decide, let's endorse John Smith and work the Republicans they identify for John Smith, it might shift that a little bit. And I just don't know what it would be. I'll tell you, to be honest, as I look at the as I look at the field myself as just a political guy, there are a couple that stand out to me, I think, as credible and substantive. I think Jessam Farrell is one. Very impressed that she left her legislative seat to take a chance on this. I think Jenny Durkin is extremely impressive. There are a couple of others, too, that I think could appeal to Republicans. But we'll see where the tone of the race is. Are we going to be way over here or kind of over here, more in the middle? We'll see.
Are we going to be here
or over here?
Yes.
Or over here.
Over there.
Got it.
Oh, I'm getting really worried. I'm beginning to agree with Kirby.
Uh-oh. This is like twice.
No, the... You know, this is really an interesting time. One, I'm glad I'm not a candidate. I'm ecstatic that I'm not a candidate.
You're enjoying this.
This is the most tumultuous period I've seen in Seattle. I've to witness it over the last 4 years and to see it and to hear it and to see the divisions that are beginning to, I think, in fissures that are beginning to break in neighborhoods.
You're talking about upzoning neighborhoods. What we tick off some of the things you're thinking of. Most tumultuous period.
I think people are tired of being told. They want to be asked. And when you're going to make change, there is a process to get people to accept it. A way to, and it, you know. So my sense is that it's caught people off balance, and so you have 21 candidates. People are all over the place politically about who they want to vote for, what they want as mayor. What I think that they want and is order and predictability and a sense of process. The city, you know, as a person who's of color, to realize that when we have the next census, this city is going to be one of the whitest in the United States. Mm-hmm. So when people talk to me about diversity, I went, well, not in Seattle. When Bellevue has more, a greater percentage of color, which stunned me. Bellevue, I'm still stunned. So I think that it is the speed in which things are happening and the change, which don't allow you to get your arms around it, and therefore you can't get your head around it, that are creating this, where are we going, how are we going to get there, an imbalance, a sense that is there order here, is there something I can predict, is there an outcome, because every time you turn around, there's...
Does that benefit Ed Murray as the incumbent, are you saying...
I have.
You know, that would be the steady, the status quo, literally the status quo.
I think it benefits Jenny Durkin. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting, you know, only in Seattle would the first woman mayor in 92 years, the first lesbian mayor ever, be considered, you know, this incredibly establishment, you know, almost Republican figure. But I do want to say, I mean, not to push back on Ron on the diversity issue. I mean, we were just talking, I'm from Houston. We were talking before the show about how shocking it kind of was to come here and realize how white the city is. But the city council is, may soon be have a majority of racial minorities if Teresa Mosqueda is elected, which is mm-hmm. fascinating. And that hasn't happened in, you know, the 16 years I've lived here. It also would have a majority of women. So you're seeing more diversity on the city council options, I think less so in the mayor's
less
race.
Diversity in the population, though, which is odd because Ron's right. I mean, I grew up in this town, went to Queen Anne High School. I was a real estate appraiser for decades, so I appraised a lot of property and saw the changes going on. And it is shocking to me that because of real estate prices and other pressures, there's been this incredible gentrification, especially in the central area, areas that used to be known as minority neighborhoods. And I live on the east side, but let me tell you something. I do believe Bellevue is more is less gentrified than Seattle. There's more minorities over there. A lot of it's East Asian, coming in from Microsoft and IT jobs, that kind of thing. But it is more diverse in some neighborhoods over in Bellevue. And folks here, it looks to me like lower-income folks and people of color being pushed in the South End, Renton, Burien, White Center being pushed further south and Federal Way. And it's a very different city than it was 4 or 8 years ago. And I think Ron has a point.
Why do you think Seattle has had no woman as a mayor? The state's had a woman as governor. We've had U.S. senators.
To go along with Eric is saying, she talks about first. There are quality candidates running. And you have to have a candidate you like. You have to have a quality candidate stands for certain things. Has there been a woman in the past running for mayor? that had those qualities and was voted down. I think Jenny has those qualities.
I don't think it's so much about, I mean, I think that qualities matter too, but I think it's a pipeline issue because you don't have women running for office here in the same numbers, largely because you kind of have to quit your job to run for office. And a lot of women are supporting families. They can't afford to just up and quit their jobs. They're not sitting on a pile of money like some of the male candidates that we've seen. And I will say Jenny Durkin is a very wealthy woman, which enables her to run for mayor full time. And, you know, and there just hasn't been a lot of push for female candidates to, I mean, I've seen young women candidates get crushed over and over by the consultant class in the city who says you're not ready yet, you're not ready.
There are women on the city council, as you said.
It's an easier job to get elected to. I mean, it's much harder to get elected mayor. You need a lot more money. You need a lot more time. You need a lot more of the political establishment behind you. I think there's a risk aversion in this city, and women are considered, you know, still in 2017, risky. I mean, it's this city, you know, I've lived in other places, and it is kind of shocking to me that we live in this, you know, in this progressive city that's supposedly so open-minded. And yet, you know, we've had one female mayor for a two-year term, and she was, you know, kicked out of office by a guy who nobody knew, who said, we need a man back in charge. That's
the history.
She was a
Republican, too, wasn't she, back in 1917? I think Bertha was a Republican.
Possibly. But that's the history. And so I think you can't ignore that history and just say, well, there hasn't been any qualified women. There's a reason for that people aren't running for office.
Can I hit one more piece? We're talking about change in the city. One, yes, Ron, you look like you really wanted to say something. No?
No, I was going to agree with Rebecca.
Okay. With Erica.
Erica.
Yeah.
I was just sitting there thinking, it's true when you were talking. I said, we have not provided a top office spot for a woman of a woman. We just haven't. And it's a head scratcher. This race will be very interesting to follow to see how in the end, who gets the mayorship. Because it's so unusual to have this long a period where it's 100 years.
The current mayor...
By the way, consultants can be a cancer. You mentioned consultants.
Seattle's current mayor has proposed a way to help people with criminal convictions rent an apartment. Basically, very basically, he wants to prohibit landlords from asking applicants about convictions that are more than 2 years old. You couldn't ask about arrests that didn't lead to a conviction. The landlord would have to prove that rejecting a tenant based on a recent conviction was not discriminatory. I talked to a man who has a criminal conviction on his record, Augustine Sita, with the Urban League, told me that people who have paid their debt to society just need a chance to live.
Anyone, whether they did time or not, if he's in a position, if his credit is good, if he's working, if he's making good money, that's not synonymous with somebody who's on his way back to prison. So many of the people that landlords fear renting to won't even qualify financially or so to move in. The people we're talking about is hardworking men and women who have done their time, who are working, who are making a good living and just want a place to live. And they don't want to be stuck with the option of a transitional house, which is almost as negative as being on the streets.
I also talked with Sean Flynn, a landlord from the Rental Housing Association, and he and Augustine Sita were both on the mayor's task force that came up with this proposal. Sean says the final product was not his first choice.
We were supportive of a certificate of restoration of opportunity bill to address issues around people with criminal records reentering society. We ended up with an ordinance that is punitive and is there to hammer people into compliance rather than build a program that changes people's minds.
So some landlords look at this in addition to the new city rules on background checks and the first come first serve renting policy and limits on move-in fees and say, look, this is my investment, my property, and I'm losing control. What do you think, Kirby?
I would tend to agree with Sean. I think and to go back to the discussion Ron and I had on the issue of the shooting of Ms. Lyles, this is a comprehensive issue. We have a serious problem with bringing people back into the system. That's why there's such a high recidivism rate, I believe. 85% or more after 5 years, most of these people commit another crime, go back, because we don't have a way to bring them into society. They have the stigma. And we have to find a way through education and housing and other things. But I do think that a lot of stuff has been shifted on landlords as if this is the only solution to the problem. And I agree with what Sean said. This is punitive, and there has to be a much more comprehensive way to look at this because this is an issue. We have people keeping going back to jail again and again because they're not given the chance when they get out to establish themselves and right themselves.
This is probably going to pass the city council, right? Looks like it.
I wouldn't think, I would think that Lisa Herbold wouldn't get up there and say, you know, with Mayor Ed Murray, City Councilmember Lisa Herbold, and say, you know, that we're going to pass this if she hadn't done some vote polling, although she said she hadn't. You know, I think I think this is an issue of fairness. And I think that if you are a landlord, I mean, you do have responsibilities. So part of being a landlord, as part of doing a lot of things in our society, you know, there are rules. You can't discriminate against people because of their gender, their sexual orientation, their race. There are, and this essentially adds criminal history older than 2 years old to those categories. So you're talking about people who have done their time. One of the objections that I've heard is, you know, from tenants, you know, or potential tenants saying, you know, I don't want to live next to one of these people. You know, they could be a bad guy. They could prey on me somehow. The fact is, you are living next to one of those people if you are a tenant, because 1 in 3 Americans has a criminal conviction of some kind. So,
one in three
or arrest record. Yeah.
Okay.
But
still, that's pretty high.
So it has a criminal history. And so, I mean,
you're including arrest with that conviction, arrest record.
I will be honest. I don't know the specifics that are included in that statistic, but it's a lot of Americans who have some kind of criminal record in their past. Sometimes it's for minor drug arrests. It, you know, is disproportionately African Americans. And so, I mean, this is trying to right an actual wrong that exists in our society. The most dangerous thing to do, you know, in terms of recidivism, is to put people directly out on the streets out of prison. And that's what happens. We have 85 people in the state every month going out directly into homelessness out of prison. And so those people are pretty likely to reoffend. You know, if you're out on the street, like, and you have no money, you maybe have an addiction, you know, you're fairly likely to end up back in jail.
You might not be able to move in with somebody you know because they can't have you on the lease now because of the restrictions. That's part of it. That's part of the reason.
Right.
This can be a part of homelessness. Anything else before we move on, Ron Sims?
I'm good.
Okay. Kirby, did you want to respond to that?
No, I'm just thinking again what we all too often is find one class or one person to blame and shove it off. This is an issue. I totally agree with everyone. This is an issue because if we don't find a way to bring these people back into society, give them a productive job, give them something to do, they're going to recommit their crimes because that's what they know, and society has then going off. But I think dumping on landlords, and I would question the 1 in 3. I'll get back to Eric on that. If it's 1 in 3, I'm really lucky because – 5 people I can think of, my closest friends and kids, we have no arrest records, so I don't know who else it would be. So I think there has to be an approach, but I agree that it's punitive. Why shove it off on landlords? Let's work on other programs we can to bring these folks back and to mainstream them so we don't have a high recidivism rate. We make them productive members of society again.
Okay, it's summertime. Should we get out of the studio in our next segment? Get out where people are... They're enjoying the sunshine. They're taking the bus. They're ramming into each other at traffic jams. That kind of good stuff?
Sure.
Okay, we'll warm up in just a moment on the Week in Review. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Ron Sims, Erica C. Barnett, and Kirby Wilbur. Did you hear about the ramming Subaru in Kent? On Highway 516, there was a traffic jam. Cars backed up. Some drivers started getting around it by using the shoulder, which you're not supposed to do. How would you feel if you're sitting in that traffic watching the scofflaws pass you by?
I honestly get furious when I see. I'm a very, I would say, calm driver. I've become more calm as I have gotten older. But I get so furious when I see people breaking the rules on the road.
Okay, will you hold that fury while I tell listeners what
happened? No, I can't stand
it. All right, so this Subaru driver is just feeling Erica Zebra in it. The Subaru driver is feeling that way about people, scofflaws, getting by. So she moves partway onto the shoulder to block the, see, you're happy. To block the evildoers, and so she's standing up to law breaking by also breaking the law because you're not supposed to be in the shoulder, but she's holding them back. Well, one of those cars getting by in the shoulder is a Jeep, and that driver's not going to be stopped, so he swings further to the right to get around her. She responds by ramming into him 3 times. The News Tribune ran the photos of the Subaru with 2 wheels off the ground. It is so caught up in that Jeep. And on our Facebook page, we asked, which car are you, the Subaru or the Jeep? It sounds like, Erica, you are the Subaru. Subaru.
I'm the Subaru.
I'm with Erica. I'm the Subaru.
I
would not have rammed the Jeep. I would have gone far enough over in the shoulder so no one's going to get by. And the person behind me would appreciate that move because he would say, right on, you're doing the right thing. And he would then or she would then move over. And we'd have a chain of cars. Nobody would get past us blocking that line.
Chain of cars on the shoulder, just moving very, very slowly.
I've done the same thing sometimes in merge lanes, where people getting way far ahead trying to cheat in rather than using the zipper method.
Yes.
I'd move over to block them just because I feel some sense of injustice having been done, and that's my job, isn't it, to enforce the law and be the tough guy.
God, Ron Sims, tell me there's another Jeep in this room. Or just waiting patiently. We haven't even. Then there's just the Zen. You're kind of a meditator, aren't you, Ron?
I do, because you can't drive anymore without seeing an offender. And they're maddening. And so my issue is just to say, relax, Ron.
So you're staying.
Really relax.
You're in the traffic jam and you're just obeying the law and relaxing, right? Listening to KOW.
Yeah,
good.
Let me tell you why, though. There was a mathematician when I was the county executive who used to say, why do we have traffic jams? And it's because people are reacting to the offender. So that once you do that, you think that you're solving, you're teaching somebody a lesson, but you are, in fact, creating a traffic jam. So I always remembered, Ron, do not be the vigilante bringing justice and then mathematically being the reason why you have a traffic jam.
Well, Erica and I, if they would deputize us,
here's the problem.
Much more revenue from the tickets we issue. We wouldn't have a revenue problem in Olympia anymore.
Here's the problem
Trooper,
with that.
Trooper Barnett?
Yeah. You know how I get out of this situation is I ride the bus. And
the smuggest answer of
I
all.
I know. It's even like smugger than a Subaru,
Of us can't ride the bus because we don't live and work on a bus line, so we have to use the car. We have to face this on 405 all the time and 520. If the state would let me issue tickets, do you know what? They would have so much money. 520 at 5:30 in the morning? Wow.
On our Facebook page, Shelley said she's Subaru. I'm so disgusted with those that take advantage of everything and everyone. If we're all going to be pigs, then pig back at you. Shauna didn't say she's the Jeep, but she did write, I'm not surprised it was the Subaru driver who snapped when someone else didn't follow the rules she thought they should. So is that an anti-Subaru comment there? By the way, the model was the Subaru Rorschach, just in case you wanted to know what she was driving.
But I'm not always nice. Can I tell you why? I was coming back from Portugal, and we were in the line to get our stamps so that we could leave the country. And something went wrong, so they ended up having 8 booths, but only one of them occupied by an employee. The line was really long, and you're watching the ticking in regards to when your plane took off.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody decided to cut into the line in front of people, right? But they were behind us. And the vigilante action was so powerful that we were all cheering. I can't say that I'm totally innocent.
No, not totally innocent, but very innocent. Ron Sims, Kirby Wilbur, Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks, everybody.
You bet. Thank you, Bill.
Enjoy 90 degrees or staying out of 90 degrees or whatever you're going to do this weekend. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in.